Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up today, as Europe celebrates a day for the seas, we look at the difficulties facing those who fish for a living and why the Holy See and the Catholic Church are fighting for their rights. And as Kenya grapples with post-election tension, we look for insight into the challenges facing the country. A climate of tension continues to hang over Kenya since violence erupted after last December's presidential election. The new government has promised security to those who fled the violence and wish to return home, but many have tried to do so only to find angry mobs who prevented them from returning to their properties. Government officials say some 60,000 people at least have returned, but statistics are unclear as to how many others have been forced back to makeshift camps where they've been forced to live for more than 4 months. December's election dispute took an ugly ethnic twist that pitted President Mwai Kibaki's Kikuyu tribe against the Luo and allied tribes loyal to opposition leader Raila Odinga. More than 1,000 people were killed and 600,000 forced from their homes. Politicians were accused of stoking long-simmering tribal divisions into the violence. Weeks of UN-sponsored peace talks led to a power-sharing government at the end of February. Well, Monsignor Renato Cozzito, an Italian Comboni missionary who has been working with the poor in Nairobi's slums, says he believes Kenyans will ultimately rise above the violence and division.
I think now there is a bit of tension in this sharing of power, but I don't expect it to be something serious. I believe that the will of the majority of the people in Kenya is certainly that they arrive at an agreement, that they implement the agreement. And also that is the will of the international community. In fact, I believe that so-called international community maybe is much more important in the Kenyan situation than what we normally think, in the sense that I will see the situation in Kenya in the context of the new scramble for Africa.
The new scramble for Africa.
I see that... especially the United States and the Chinese are extremely interested in African resources in the very short term. And in the African market, the natural
such
resources,
such as oil, diamonds,
minerals. Gold, minerals in general, and so on. Also in the African market in the longer term. So there is a big competition going on. The Chinese were not present in Africa up to 10 years ago. Maybe they were present ideologically, but now they are present economically. They are present with agreement and investments and so on. And they were not present before. And their presence is increasing very rapidly. And clearly, the United States of America and the Europeans are very worried about this. There is a new scramble for Africa, for African resources. And this has played an important part, I believe, in what has happened in Kenya.
Because
before the election, the government that took power 5 years ago had moved, not for ideological reasons, but simply for economic benefit, for economic profit, has moved towards the east. For instance, the government gave contracts for cars that usually were going to the Great Britain with the Land Rover. These contracts were given to Toyota. And some other contracts for big works in Kenya were given to Chinese companies.
Big public works,
big public infrastructure. Like infrastructure, like road, right. The road from Mombasa to Nairobi. So this has worried the other powers that are present in Kenya. So they have supported the opposition in the campaign, And unwillingly, they supported what the opposition was doing, that was to divide the Kenyans along tribal lines.
Now you say unwillingly or unwittingly?
Yes, unwittingly, most probably. I believe so. I don't think that was in the plan. But when the problem erupted, they realized that it was better to stop, because if Kenya is falling apart, all the East Africa would fall apart. Kenya is surrounded by countries that are unstable. If you look around Kenya, there is only Tanzania that is a stable country. But all the other countries, let's say in the last 20 years, they have very serious problems. From Somalia, where the problem is still there, Ethiopia, Sudan, Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi. So if Kenya falls apart, it would be a disaster, a total disaster, and Africa risk of going, East Africa risk of going out of control completely.
Well, in fact, since 1963, when Kenya had its independence from Great Britain, it has been a model of peace, basically, in Africa. So this is a disastrous situation that Kenya could find itself on the brink of continued violence. What is preventing that from happening?
Well, now the whole international community, I think, is working for preventing that. And very strong pressure has been put on the two protagonists of these failed elections, let's say, to agree and to take Kenya out of this situation that really risk of getting completely out of control.
Why do you say failed election?
Failed because, in reality, we don't know who won. And it's very difficult to understand who cheated more during the elections. Maybe there was some cheating from the government, but there was a lot of intimidation also from the other side. So to know really who Kenyan people voted for is very difficult to know. It will be very difficult even to reconstruct, because in some parts of the country, maybe the voting itself was counted properly, but the intimidation that went on before and during the day of the election is difficult to measure and difficult to know what really happened. But we have heard a lot of tales about people that they did not go to vote because they were afraid of being beaten or being even killed at the time, the very day of the election. So, you see, we are now in a position where we have to try to stay peacefully, go ahead, find a new solution, most probably a new constitution within 1 or 2 years, and move ahead from there. Because what has happened recently is really difficult to judge. Now there is a commission that has been set up to try to understand what has happened, but it will be quite difficult to reconstruct exactly what has happened.
During this violence that erupted after the elections in December, there was one horrible episode of a church being put on fire.
Yeah.
All the people inside were killed. Some 30 people, I believe.
Yeah, 30.
Did religion play a part in any of this?
I don't think so, because the motivation of the people were never religious. And I believe also that the division among the different Christian denominations did not play a significant role. Actually, they were quite irrelevant. Religious leaders were unable to call effectively for peace because people were strongly divided along different problems, economic problems, and tribal problems. Though I believe that the tribal division was rather artificial, it was created by the politicians who wanted to hide behind this tribal mask. They wanted to hide their economic interest. But religion did not play an evident part. The fact that these people were burned in a church does not relate in any way with religion. It was simply because the people took refuge there thinking that they would be safe. And all the same, they were killed because they belonged to a different ethnic group. That was the real reason. There was no real religious feeling or religious motivation in that. As I said, the criticism in Kenya of the majority of people is to the religious leader for having been ineffective or not credible enough during the time of the troubles to intervene. Unfortunately, most people perceived the religious leaders divided along tribal or economic interest as a politician. So they were not seen as very credible. Mm-hmm. It may not be true, but this is the perception of the people.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said that this ethnic or tribal rivalry was, in a sense, fabricated by, you say, politicians. What is preventing this from getting out of control? Have politicians backed down from these sort of statements?
They have realized how this, you know, when you touch problem related to the deep identity of the people, I don't like to call it tribal. We are using this term just to understand each other, but when you touch the deep identity of the people, you touch something that is irrational, something that is, you know, you cannot measure the reaction you can have. And some politicians played on this very strongly for the last 2 years. And then the situation went out of hand. And now they have stepped back. Also because, you know, economically, for instance, those who were most damaged were the people in the Luo area, were those siding with the opposition. And in the rioting against the government, they damaged themselves because things were destroyed. I mean, there is the town of Kisumu has been reduced. It went back of 20 years, according to the majority of the people.
Is that a highly touristic area?
No. It's far from the coast. It's more an area where agriculture is important, fishing is important. Mm. But it's not a touristic area.
Because I know that they also are concerned about tourism falling off because of all the violence.
Sure.
Which is an important part of the Kenyan economy.
A very important part, certainly. But that is the coast. And the coast was basically peaceful during this time of trouble. Apart from Mombasa itself, that is the major town on the coast, the other parts of the coast were basically peaceful.
Your hopes for the future. What do you see happening? What gives you a reason for hope?
I think that the majority of the Kenyan people, they have seen the danger of going on along this road. A good positive reaction we have seen in this time was generally from the civil society, the Organization for Human Rights and so on, and also from the Kenyan media that have mobilized to keep Kenya together and to help people to think and not to divide themselves along the tribal lines. They have helped people to realize that the power for economic control of Kenya rather than a problem of tribal division. So that has been very positive. And I believe this will continue. I believe that Kenyans are not ready to change the course now towards peace and towards reconstruction of the country, towards reconstruction of the economy. There will be a very, very strong resistance. I believe even in the last day of the troubles, what we had seen is that people were not ready to do the so-called mass actions. At a certain point, mass actions were called off, not because there was a real desire of peace at that stage, but because people understood that people would not go in the street anymore.
They fear violence.
They realized that they were destroying the country. So it was a wrong road. I believe this feeling is now very deep in the majority of Kenya. They want to go ahead, keeping the unity, the stability, the peace of the country.
Well, naturally, we join Monsignor Renato Kidzito there in his hope that Kenyans will rise above the violence for a future of peace and prosperity. Thank you. the open seas for days and sometimes weeks or even months at a time. With shoddy living conditions, little time to rest, spoiled food to eat, and sometimes mistreatment by the ship's crew or captain. That's sometimes the sort of millions of men and women who make a living from fishing. More fishers die on the job than workers in almost any other profession. And sometimes, instead of receiving a just wage, they're given a share of the value of the fish they help catch. Until now, no international legislation has protected the working conditions of the world's fishers. But now, under the UN umbrella, 437 countries in June 2007 overwhelmingly agreed to a new convention for fishermen. But not one nation has yet ratified it. And that, says the Vatican office responsible for the apostleship of the sea, must change.
Regarding both maritime transport and fishing, the ILO adopted some important conventions in 2006 and 2007 that represent a great opportunity for the maritime world. Now the apostleship of the sea needs to carry out a task of advocacy around the world so that these conventions will be ratified and have force of law as soon as possible.
Archbishop Agostino Marchetto is secretary of the Pontifical Council for Migrants.
The world of fishing is in crisis. World fish stock is at its lowest. For the first time in the world history, it is feared that fish will disappear from the seas. Since more than a billion people depend on fishing for their food needs, and an estimated 41 million people work directly in this activity. The exhaustion of fish resources represents, therefore, a very great danger for all these people. Entire communities of fishers are threatened with extinction, and so a whole way of life is in the process of disappearing. The workers of the sea tend to work and act individually. This is why their voice is rarely heard on the national or international level. It is also AM's duty to be the voice of the voiceless by helping them to become aware of the situation they are living and the deadlines they will have to face. It is also a duty to always be close and have solidarity with all the living forces working in this sector for the good and dignity of man.
Ted Richardson is one of those who's calling for the ratification of the new Convention for the Good and Dignity of Fishermen. He's regional director of the Apostleship of the Sea in Oceania. I asked him why no one has signed this important protocol.
I struggle to understand the rationale in things like the ILO.
Which is the International Labour Organization.
Yeah, which will sit down and thrash out a fundamental right of every person to care for what they need, what their minimum standards of working and conditions and environment that they work in it should be like. And all the countries will say, this is great, we have a document here that we can call Convention 188. And then they make recommendations for minimum standards of wages, food, these sorts of things for people. And they put a recommendation to it. And then it gets put on a shelf. 2 years later, we get this recommendation and this convention coming out to us, and it says, well, how many nations have ratified? Since they all agreed to it, how many nations have ratified? None. Not a one.
So all these nations, though, are involved in the production of this convention.
Yeah.
However, none of them wants to sign up to it.
No. It's just because they say, well, we've done our work.
Our consciences are clear.
Mm-hmm. We've said what the minimum standards are here. Who's going to be the first one to ratify it? And they all sit back and wait for somebody else to be first.
The first one.
And everyone says, well, we've got better standards than this in that country anyway, so why bother ratifying it? The point of ratifying is that it makes it law that people can't abuse somebody else's labour. That if a ship came to my country and we've ratified this, we have the power to say, hang on, we've got you. We can find you under our law because we've ratified this ILO convention. So we can actually seize your vessel. We can take your stock. We can charge you with breaking the law. But at the moment, we say, it's none of our business. You know, you can have a 10-year-old child working on a fishing vessel and nothing we can do about it.
But presumably many of these countries, as you say, have their own individual legislation that guarantees that a 10-year-old child is not working on a sea vessel.
And we have it in Australia. We have minimum standards for Australians working on these ships. The National Director of India was telling me that their minimum level of somebody working on a ship is 18 years of age. But if another ship came in with a child of 10 or 8, nothing they can do because they've not ratified this. So they can't say, sorry, you can't have that person work on that ship. It is illegal to have that person work on that ship. And until you employ people at the right age, we won't let your vessel go.
So explain this to me a little bit better. A ship comes in from Southeast Asia or something into an Australian port. It has a 10-year-old child working on board. Mm. The Australian port authorities are not allowed to do anything about it?
No. It's under a different country's rules and regulations.
But it's on Australian territory.
Yeah, but we've not ratified the convention, so we have no power to inspect it. Our maritime safety authorities cannot go on board the ship and look at the food conditions or look at the sleeping conditions on board the ship or the minimum age of the employees on the ship or how they're paid or how they're sustained. They have no authority to do anything other than say, is your ship seaworthy? Will it sink in our waters? If it won't sink in our waters, then off you go again.
So why aren't countries signing up for this?
I struggle to understand why.
They just don't want to be bothered. It's an extra police and security cost. Yeah.
They write the legislation for the ILO, and then it goes into a shelf, and it sits there. And the guys in the ILO struggle themselves to get these things out into the public. They come to us in the Pontifical Council meetings and said, we need to ask your help to get this to your governments so that your governments can understand from you that this is needed, because they're not listening to us. We're just the ILO. We might have a nice big logo and a nice big place that we all come to meet, but unless you do it in your country, it's not going to happen. We can scream and yell, but they're not going to listen to us. They'll only listen to you and your people because you're the voters. You're the ones that put the governments in power, and you're the ones that can take them out. And we can't do anything but ask them, please, can you ratify this? So we need to rattle cages in our governments. And every nation needs to look at these conventions and resolutions and say, adopt them. They're not so hard. You've already agreed to them. You've already had them on the table. You've read them all and you've said, yes, we agree to them. Adopt them. Make them work.
And what are some of the things that are contained in this convention?
The main things are minimum age.
It's called, actually, I see the brochure here, it's called Decent Working Conditions, Safety and Social Protection, Working in Fishing Convention.
Yeah. That is basically exactly what it says. It's the working conditions, what hours that people are made to work. They can't work people for 22 hours a day. They have a minimum food requirement and safe food. They're not eating spoiled food. That young people are not brought into the industry below a certain age. That they have an education, that they are trained and educated in the work that they're undertaking, that they have the ability to be able to go ashore, to spend time, to make sure their families are fairly compensated for that person's employment. Then that person gets compensated well for their employment as well. These are just the minimum standards that we should have, that we expect in our jobs. In the first world, that we look for a job, we know when we go for an interview for a job that we're going to have a certain amount of hours that we're going to be working for, that we will have a morning tea and a lunch, that we will have a time that we will knock off and go home, that we'll have a weekend or we're paid overtime or
health insurance, retirement, all that sort of thing.
Superannuation, and whether you're compensated if you're injured at work.
Mm. But what about these? But isn't this quite onerous for many governments if they have to start policing or investigating to see whether even, you know, small family-run businesses, fishing vessels and so on, who might have one or two or three or four people working together? Isn't that maybe perhaps one of the reasons why governments haven't signed up to this? Because it's quite an onerous thing.
In some ways you could say yes, but if you're looking at a family business, then a family work at making it better for the family. They work at looking after each other. They care about each other. They're not going to work one of their family into the ground to say, you know, you keep slaving away so that, you know, I can have some time off or I can go on a holiday. So a family business is probably a good analogy for governments to look at to say, would I look after my children this way? Would I treat my kids this way? Let's make sure that if you need a doctor, we make sure we get you to a doctor. You need good food, let's make sure I get you good food. Not feed you poorly, not treat you poorly.
Do you ever get in this work that you do jaded? Do you ever feel, I'm fighting for the rights of these people and nothing's happening?
It becomes frustrating at times when you feel like often you're just a voice in the wilderness, you know, crying out, say, come on, do something. You get annoyed, and then all of a sudden you get a seafarer comes up to you and he'll say, thank you. And it'll just be, thank you for what? I didn't do anything. You did a lot for me. You spoke for me. You talked for us as fishers. You talked for us as seafarers. We heard you on the radio, or we read something about you in the newspaper, and you have nothing to gain by talking for us, and you talk for us. And just to get one person to say thank you just builds you up to say, I can fight harder, I can work harder, I can do more. Because you know you've made an effect on somebody. Maybe somebody you've never met, somebody you will never ever see, but you know that in your heart you've made something better for somebody else somewhere else. And that's the important thing that we should all have in our life, that whether you're a radio presenter here in the Vatican and you don't see a seafarer ever in your life, you know that through this media you have touched a seafarer, you have touched somebody, you've made their life better. And in doing that, you've improved the world. You've made it better for seafarers. The listeners that listen to the broadcast will go and talk to somebody else, will talk to a family member and say, I heard this, I now know what this is about, and I can do something. So in every way you do something, you improve it. So that builds you up as a person. You say, we can make a difference, whether we're one or whether we're many, we can make a difference. And we do.
Ted Richardson is Regional Director of the Apostleship of the Sea for Oceania. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.